Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Ramita Iyer, research analyst at the Institute. In this episode, I'm pleased to be joined by Professor C. Rajamohan, visiting research professor at ISAS. We will be discussing the evolving geoeconomics in South Asia. Welcome to the podcast, Prof. Mohan.
Thank you. Thank you, Ramita.
So there's been a change in India's stance on managing its regional affairs, where it has moved from resisting working with third parties to now engaging in greater collaboration with external partners. The Indo-Japanese initiatives in the region, be it the initiative to promote sub-regional connectivity with Bangladesh or the joint effort by Delhi and Tokyo to support Sri Lanka's debt restructuring, bear testimony to this. In a recent piece that you wrote, you mentioned that this marks a major structural change unfolding in the subcontinent. Could you please elaborate on this?
I think one of the great legacies that independent India inherited from the British Raj was the notion of an exclusive sphere of influence in South Asia. And of course, South Asia was largely a single entity under the British Raj. The pre-partition subcontinent was a large place. Historically, Britain tried to keep other European powers out of South Asia. So in some sense, the same policy continued when India took charge, though the subcontinent was no longer united. I mean, it was divided in the partition. But yet the idea that India's primacy should be sustained and that India would not allow other powers to meddle into the affairs of the subcontinent. So that became one of the policy premises of independent India. You could, of course, argue that it was not really entirely successful because Pakistan, from the very beginning, tried to mobilize other powers, especially the United States and China, to balance India. We also saw later the Soviet intervention into Afghanistan. So I think the India did not have the power of the British Raj to actually keep other powers out. So the rest of the world was beginning to impinge on South Asia. So at least beyond Pakistan and Afghanistan, Delhi tried to ensure that, look, the third party involvement in the smaller neighbors was limited. So that has been the dominant policy, where India contested the role of the other powers, pressurized the neighboring countries to limit exposure to the third parties. But I think that policy began to change over the last decade or so as India began to discover that, look, you can't really insulate South Asia from the rest of the world. While the idea of sphere of influence sounds good, but I think in practice, implementing it is very hard. So what we've seen India do in the last few years is really to actually partner with like-minded countries to produce goods, collective public goods in South Asia. This policy, of course, was partly triggered by the fact that many of India's neighbors were already mobilizing China, especially China, to balance against India. And as China rose on India's periphery, the role of China began to grow. So I think what India did was to really to contest that it needed partners, other partners like the US or Japan and others, to be able to deal with the new realities on the ground. So that has been the new direction. While India, given its size, will remain the lead partner in the region, but I think it can benefit by partnering, say, a country like Japan, which brings in financial and other resources, for example, on the infrastructure race in the subcontinent. So I think to be able to give an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative, you needed other more capable partners, which is where I think the role of Japan has come into the subcontinent. On the security sphere, too, India's, encourage the US to play a larger role. It is no longer blocking its neighbors from security partnerships with the United States, etc.
So looking more closely at China's role, so the country has been actively involved in the affairs of India's neighbors since the 1960s. And in recent years, it's undeniable that there has been an intensification of geopolitical competition between India and China. What is your reading of where India-China relations stand today with respect to their engagements within South Asia? And how much of a role has China played in persuading India to recalibrate its regional policies?
I think this notion that India can keep China out was fundamentally unsustainable. Because as we mentioned in the article, even going back to the 60s, even a underdeveloped or weak China could bring in enough resources into the subcontinent. It certainly, for example, in Nepal, it started building infrastructure in the 1960s. It was building, you know, trans-Himalayan infrastructure in Pakistan. So I think for them, you know, just by being in the neighborhood, they could do things, offer an alternative to India. But once China rose to be the second largest economy, today China is everywhere. I mean, whether it is the Panama Canal or the South Pacific Islands, there's no corner of the world where the Chinese presence is not felt. So it'll be even more difficult today for India to imagine that it can actually keep out China, which is the second largest economy, and a neighboring country to the subcontinent. So I think the next best thing for India has been to offer actually credible alternatives to what China is doing, so that it's not that China's BRI is not the only game in town. India is doing more, you know, infrastructure support programs on its own. It's partnering with Japan to offer an alternative. So I think you can't just tell the neighbors, look, don't go to China, and that I don't have the resources to do the project. So I think the partnership with like-minded countries to offer alternatives, that's, I think, has come as a sensible alternative to the diktat-driven policy of simply saying, look, nobody else should come into the region, because like King Canute, I mean, that's not a proposition that could be sustained.
So the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, which began in February 2022, has had profound diplomatic and economic ramifications worldwide. What is your assessment of the conflict's impact on the behavior of countries in South Asia, as well as the overall geoeconomic outlook of the region?
Because I think the crisis really worsened situation in South Asia. We already had the COVID-19 pandemic, which really damaged the South Asian economies in an immense manner. Sri Lanka, for example, really went into a tailspin. We see Pakistan today facing severe crisis. And the Ukraine war coming soon after the COVID-19 pandemic had made the situation a lot worse for a number of countries in relation to sustaining the debt, in relation to food and fuel security, in relation to sustaining the agriculture through fertilizer imports. So I think what we've seen is really an accentuation of the crisis in the subcontinent because of the Ukraine war. In terms of the political impact in the subcontinent, we've seen Pakistan do something interesting. I mean, Imran Khan was in February 23rd. He landed in Moscow. He was sitting with Putin when Russia ordered the invasion of Ukraine. So I think probably that was a random event, I would say, that I think Putin, simply played Imran Khan, because Imran Khan and Pakistan were looking to engage Russia. And the Russians, I think, simply got him into Moscow the day of the invasion. Since then, I think Pakistan has sought to correct its position. Today, it is supplying arms to Ukraine. It's trying to get closer back to the Americans. So I think they've realized that they need the Americans, a long-standing partner. So I think they're recalibrating their position on Ukraine. The rest of the region, India in particular, from the beginning took a careful position while emphasizing the question of sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, it was not going to simply stand behind the West into simply denouncing Russia because of the large interdependence that India has in the security sphere with Russia. And many of the smaller countries have largely tried to stay out of this crisis without having to pick sides, and they've really gone with the flow, looking for international support to cope with their economic crisis. We've seen Bangladesh take advanced precaution, go to the IMF. Sri Lanka has managed to negotiate with the IMF, and Pakistan is still struggling to get the international support to manage its economic crisis.
In recent times, there has been an increasing interest among developed countries, with several of them coming out with their own Indo-Pacific strategies, articulated first by Japan when Shinzo Abe outlined its framework in 2007. Many countries have followed suit in prioritizing the Indo-Pacific in their foreign policies. there is the idea of the free and open Indo-Pacific, and countries have also been working with each other through forums like the Quad and the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. In a recent interesting development, Bangladesh has unveiled its own Indo-Pacific strategy as well. What does this mean for the evolving geoeconomic calculations in South Asia?
I think India was the first country to fully embrace the idea of the Indo-Pacific. It took some time. I mean, as you mentioned, Shinzo Abe spoke about the confluence of the two seas in the Indian Parliament in 2007. But it was really 11 years later that Prime Minister Narendra Modi speaking at Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. This is 2018. That it actually formally articulated an Indian position on Indo-Pacific. Till then, in the intervening decade, India was hesitant. I mean, not sure what this meant, how this would play out. But I think in 2018, India actually developed its own idea of an Indo-Pacific that is somewhat different from the U.S. position of looking for a more inclusive strategy and one that did not offend the ASEAN countries. Because the ASEAN countries in Southeast Asia were worried about whether Quad was going to undermine the regional forum's centrality. So therefore, there's a lot of emphasis on ASEAN centrality in that speech by Mr. Modi. Now, since then, I think the Indo-Pacific has gained traction. The Biden administration has doubled down on the Trump initial ideas, and it's pursuing this more vigorously. So what we've seen in the subcontinent is really countries getting caught up in this because of the, for example, in Nepal, where the Chinese influence has been very strong and the communist parties have been in power in Nepal. So there's a whole vigorous debate about should Nepal be drawn into the Indo-Pacific or not. So I think there we've seen the Nepalese reject the idea of Indo-Pacific, even when they took the U.S. assistance. In Sri Lanka, again, I mean, there was a lot of hesitation of embracing the idea of Indo-Pacific. In Bangladesh, in fact, the Trump administration had reached out to Bangladesh, looking at Bangladesh as an important player potentially in the Indo-Pacific. But since then, I think under the Biden administration, the relationships between Washington and Dhaka have not been too good because of the human rights and other issues. So therefore, I think Bangladesh has decided to, you know, come up with its own ideas so that as a large successful economy today, I think it was a smart move by Bangladesh that they eagerly seeking to become a more maritime nation because Bangladesh is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's increasingly an exporting nation, especially in the apparel sector. So for them, connecting to the Indo-Pacific without alienating China, of course. The moment you say Indo-Pacific, the Chinese are upset. But I think they see as part of their overall balancing strategy, they can actually engage India, Japan, US, and China in a manner that their own interests will be better secured.
Finally, coming back to the recent Indo-Japanese initiatives, but also looking more broadly at similar initiatives in the region, how do you see countries like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh benefit from more regional competition between bigger powers who are vying to increase their geoeconomic footprint in South Asia? What is in it for them?
See, normally when we say Cold War competition, people say, look, it's actually hurts the countries of the region. The countries have to choose, countries have to make, unwanted choices. But competition also increases the leverage of smaller countries. That today, when there is a competition between India and China, for example, the smaller countries can actually, they can actually play one against the other, or smartly, they can get assistance from both countries. For example, India. India got a lot of assistance, both from US and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So I think if you have a coherent state that believes, it can navigate a contested situation, that it can actually pick and choose specific projects, set its own terms for economic engagement, demand greater, more liberal terms for economic assistance. So all those possibilities open up. So my sense is Bangladesh has navigated this very well on the BRI question over the last many years without getting into the trouble that China, Pakistan and Sri Lanka have gotten. It has been more careful in terms of how it negotiated with India, with Japan, with the Chinese. I think Sri Lanka and Pakistan made a single switch to really one side. And I think that's got them into trouble. But I think Sri Lanka is now trying to adjust that strategy. And my sense is Pakistan too, I think, is beginning to recalibrate its strategy between US and China. If you remember General Bajwa, the previous army chief, in March 2021, talked about geoeconomics, and where he said, look, while CPEC is important, that is the China-Pakistan economic corridor, is important for Pakistan, it was not giving up on its other friends, that is the Western friends. So I think what was initially seemed to focus exclusively on China, they were beginning to also look at traditional partners like the US. But in the Imran Khan period, there was a bit of a problem with this, where things went out of the way. But today, I think Pakistan too is going to leverage its position to get better gains from engaging both US and China.
Prof. Mohan, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.